And at my command. This, for Francis Carver, was a very long speech. At its conclusion, he folded his arms across his chest, and his expression closed. He frowned at Gascoigne. "Listen," he said. "What's your interest on account of?" "You'd do well to tell me plain. I don't like a slippery dealer." Gascoigne remembered that the man had murdered his own child. The thought was strangely thrilling. Lightly, he said, "I've thought of something that might be of some help to you." Carver's scowl deepened. "Who says I need help?"
"You're right," said Gascoigne. "I am impertinent."
"Say it, though," said Carver.
"Well, here," said Gascoigne. "As I mentioned before, my late wife's father worked in shipping insurance. His speciality was P&I, protection and indemnity."
"I told you I don't have that."
"Yes," Gascoigne said, "but there's a good chance that the man who sold you this ship, what was his name?"
"Lauderback," said Carver.
Gascoigne paused in a show of surprise.
"Not the politician?"
"Yes."
"Alistair Lauderback? But he's in Okitika now, running for the Westland seat."
"Go on with what you were saying. P&I.
"Yes,"
Gascoigne said, shaking his head.
"Well, there's a good chance that Mr. Lauderback, if he owned several ships, belonged to some sort of a shipowners' association. There's a good chance that he paid a yearly fee into a mutual fund called P&I, as an additional insurance that was of a slightly different nature than what you and I might think of as conventional cover."
"To protect the cargo?"
"No," said Gascoigne. "P&I works more like a mutual pool, into which all the shipowners pay a yearly fee, and out of which they can then draw down funds if they find themselves liable for any damages that regular insurers refuse to touch. Liabilities of the kind that you're facing now. Wreck removal, for instance. It's possible that Godspeed could remain protected, even though the ownership of the ship has changed."
"How?"
He spoke the word without curiosity.
"Well, if P&I was taken out some years ago, and this is the first significant accident that this particular ship has sustained, then Mr. Lauderback might be in credit against Godspeed. You see, P&I doesn't work like regular insurance. There aren't any shareholders, and no company, really. Nobody's looking to make a profit off anyone else. Instead, it's a cooperative body of men, all of them shipowners themselves. Every man pays his dues every year, until there's enough in the pool to cover them all. After that, the ships stay covered, at least until something goes wrong, and then somebody has to dip into the pool for some reason. The notion of being in credit applies very nearly."
"Like a private account," Carver said. "For Godspeed."
"Exactly."
Carver thought about this.
"How would I know about it?"
Gascoigne shrugged.
"You could ask around. The association would have to be registered, and the shipowners would have to be listed by name. This is assuming that Lauderback indeed belongs to such a group, of course. But I would venture to say that it's very likely that he does."
In fact, this was more than likely. It was certain. Alistair Lauderback did have protection and indemnity against all his crafts, and each ship was in credit to the tune of nearly £1,000, and Carver was legally entitled to draw down these funds to help pay for the removal of the wreck from the Hokitika Spit, so long as he filed his appeal before the middle of May, whereupon a year would have passed since the sale of the craft, and Lauderback's legal obligation to Godspeed would cease. Gascoigne knew all this for certain because he had made the inquiries himself, first in the offices of Balfour Shipping, and then in the news archives of the Times, and then at the Harbour Master's office, and then at the Reserve Bank. He knew that Lauderback belonged to a small cooperative of shipowners called the Garrity Group, so named for its most prominent member, John Hincher Garrity, who was, as Gascoigne had discovered, an enthusiastic champion of the Age of Sail, the imminent twilight of that era notwithstanding, and who was also, it transpired, the incumbent Member of Parliament for the electorate of Heathcote in the East, and Lauderback's very good friend. We ought to clarify that Gascoigne had made these inquiries in the service of a separate investigation, one that was not concerned with maritime insurance or with John Hincher Garrity in the slightest. Since the night of the 27th of January, he had spent long hours in the harbour master's office, poring over old logs and old pages of the shipping news. He had worked with Löwenthal to examine all the old political bulletins in the Leader, the Otago Witness, the Daily Southern Cross, and the Littleton Times, and he had skimmed through all the archives at the courthouse that pertained to George Shepherd's appointment, the temporary police camp, and the future jail. He had been looking for something very particular, one thread of evidence to connect Shepherd to Lauderback, or Lauderback to Crosby Wells, or Crosby Wells to Shepherd, or perhaps to connect all three. Gascoigne felt very sure that at least one of these possible connections was significant to the mystery at hand. So far, however, his research had turned up nothing useful at all. The discovery that Godspeed was insured against extraordinary damages was no exception to this nothing useful, for Lauderback's insurance history had no bearing upon the case of Crosby Wells, and nor was it connected in any way to George Shepherd or to the jailhouse currently under construction. But Gascoigne did have some experience in the field of maritime insurance, as he had admitted to Francis Carver, and he had not lied in saying that the subject was of some curiosity to him, being the profession of his former father-in-law, and therefore the subject of much drawing-room conversation over years past. He had made a note of Lauderback's affiliation to the Garrity Group with interest, filing it away in his mind as something to be examined in better detail at a later time. Aubert Gascoigne knew that Francis Carver was a brute, and he did not care to court his friendship. He felt, however, that to get Carver on his side would be somehow valuable, and he had solicited the other man's attention on the spit that afternoon with that purpose in mind. Carver was still thinking about protection and indemnity.
"I suppose I'd need Lauderback's consent," he said, "to lay claim to that cover. I suppose I'd need him to sign something."
"Perhaps you would," Gascoigne replied, "but the fact that only 10 months have passed since Godspeed changed hands might be worth something. That might be a loophole."
Indeed it was.
"And the fact that you inherited a standard policy from Lauderback might be worth something, too. Why, if you inherit the whole, you inherit its parts, do you not?"
"Indeed you do."
With a flourish, Gascoigne concluded, "You are sailing in New Zealand waters, and if there was no dereliction on your part, as you say, then it's very possible that you will be entitled to lay claim to those funds."
He had done his research well. Carver nodded, seeming impressed.
"Anyway," Gascoigne said, sensing that the seeds of curiosity had been adequately sowed, "you ought to look into it. You might save yourself a great deal of money."
He turned his cigarette over in his hand, examining its ember, to give Carver a chance to look him over unobserved.
"What's your stake in this?" said Carver presently.
"None whatsoever," said Gascoigne. "As I told you, I work for the magistrate's court."
"You've got a friend in P&I, maybe?"
"No," Gascoigne said, "I don't. That's not the way it works, as I've told you."
He flicked the end of his cigarette onto the rocks below the beacon.
"You're just a man who tells another man about loopholes."
"I suppose I am," Gascoigne said.
"And then strolls away."
Gascoigne lifted his hat.
"I shall take that as my cue," he said. "Good afternoon, Captain
Carver,"
said the former captain, shaking Gascoigne's hand very firmly this time.
"Frank Carver's my name."
"And I'm Aubert Gascoigne,"
Gascoigne reminded him with a pleasant smile.
"I can be found at the courthouse, should you ever need me. Well, good luck with Godspeed."
"All right," Carver said.
"She really is a marvellous craft."
Gascoigne, strolling away, felt a kind of dawning wonder at himself. He kept his face forward and did not look back, knowing that Carver's dark eyes had followed him down the spit and around the edge of the quay and all the way to the southern end of Revel Street, where he turned the corner and disappeared from view. Suk Yong Sheng, en route to Canyere to seek an interview with his compatriot Kui Long,
was at that moment very deep in thought, his hands locked behind his back, his eyes fixed sightlessly upon the ground before him. He hardly registered the figures he passed along the roadside, nor the laden dray carts that clattered by, nor the infrequent riders making for the gorge, every man hatless and in shirt sleeves, enjoying the pale summer sun that seemed, for its rarity, to shine with a providential, good-hearted light. The mood along the Canieri road was merry. Through the trees there came occasionally a snatch of a hymn, sung unaccompanied and in unison, from one of the makeshift chapels at the inland camps. Ah, Suk paid no attention. His reunion that morning with Lydia Greenway, now Lydia Wells, had deeply unsettled him, and as a kind of conciliation to his unrest, he was replaying his own history in his mind, narrating the very same tale, in fact, that he had related to our Quee 3 weeks ago. When Francis Carver had first made his introduction to the Suk family, he had been but 21, and our Suk, as a boy of 12, had very naturally looked up to him. Carver was a terse and brooding young man, born in Hong Kong to a British merchant trader and raised at sea. He was fluent in Cantonese, though he cherished no love for China, and meant to leave that place as soon as he acquired a ship of his own, an ambition he referenced very frequently. He worked for the Guangzhou branch of the merchant firm Dent & Co., of which his father was a high-ranking official, and he was responsible for overseeing the transfer of Chinese wares to and from the export warehouses along the Pearl River. One of these warehouses was owned by Suk Yongsheng's father, Suk Chunyuan. Suk Yongsheng understood very little about the financial operations of his father's business. He knew that the Suk warehouse served as a liaison point for buyers, the majority of which were British merchant firms. He knew that Dent & Co. was by far the most illustrious and well-connected of these firms, and that his father was very proud of this association. He knew that his father's clients all paid for their wares in silver ore, and that this was a further point of pride for Suk Chunyuan. He knew also that his father hated opium, and that he held the imperial commissioner, Lin Tse-su, in very high esteem. Ah Suk did not know the significance of any of these particulars, but he was a loyal son, and he accepted his father's beliefs without comment, trusting them to be both virtuous and wise. In February 1839, the Suk warehouse was targeted for an imperial investigation, a fairly routine procedure, but a dangerous one, for under Commissioner Lin's decree, any Chinese merchants harbouring opium faced the penalty of death. Suk Chunyuan welcomed the imperial forces into his warehouse cordially, where they discovered, hidden amongst the tea, some 30 or 40 crates of opium resin, each weighing roughly 50 pounds. Suk Chunyuan's protestations came to nothing. He was executed without trial and at once. Ah Suk did not know what to believe. His natural trust in his father's honesty prompted him to believe that the man had been framed, and his natural trust in his father's acumen made him doubt that the man could have been framed. He was in two minds, but he had no time to contemplate the matter, for within a week of the execution, war broke out in Guangzhou. Fearing for his own safety and for the safety of his mother, who had been driven near to madness with grief, Ah Suk turned to the only man he knew to trust, the young delegate from Dent & Co., Francis Carver. It transpired that Mr. Carver was more than happy to take on the Suk family business as a holding and to accept all burdens of organization and management upon himself, at least, he said, until Ah Suk's grief had run its course and the civil wars had quieted or resolved themselves. In a show of kindness to the boy, Carver suggested that he might like to continue working in the export trade in order to honour the memory of his late father, disgraced though that memory now was. If Ah Suk wished it, Carver could find work for him packing merchandise, a decent, honourable job, if menial, which would see him through the war. This proposition gratified Ah Suk extremely. Within hours of this conversation, he had become Francis Carver's employee. For the next 15 years, Ah Suk packed chaff around specimens of porcelain and china, wrapped bolts of printed silk in paper, stacked caddies of tea into boxes,
loaded and unloaded packages, hammered the lids of shipping crates, pasted labels onto cartons, and itemized those finely wrought and purposeless objects that were termed, upon the merchandise inventories, chinoiserie. He saw Carver only infrequently over this period, for the latter was often at sea, but their interactions, when they happened, were always cordial. It was their custom to sit upon the wharf together and share a bottle of liquor, gazing out over the estuary as the water turned from brown to blue to silver and finally to black, whereupon Carver would rise, clap his hand upon Arsuk's shoulder, toss the empty bottle into the river, and depart. In the summer of 1854, Carver returned to Guangzhou after several months' absence, and informed Arsuk, now a man of nearly 30 years, that their agreement was finally to come to an end. His lifelong ambition to one day command a trade vessel had at last been realized. Dent & Co. was to establish a trade run to Sydney and the Victorian goldfields, and his father had chartered a handsome clipper ship, the Palmerston, on his behalf. It was a fine promotion, and one that Carver could not ignore. He had come, he said, to bid the Suk family and this era of his life goodbye. Arsuk received Carver's farewell with sadness. By this time his mother was dead, and the opium wars had given way to a new rebellion in Guangzhou, one that was bloody and incensed. It promised war and perhaps even the end of empire. Change was in the air. Once Carver was gone, the warehouse sold, and the relationship with Dent & Co. dissolved, Arsuk would be severed from his former life completely. On impulse, he begged to be taken along. He could try his hand on the Victoria goldfields, to which place many of his countrymen had already sailed. Perhaps, he said, he could forge a new life for himself there, as they had done. There was nothing left for him in China. Carver acquiesced to his suggestion without enthusiasm. He supposed that Arsuk could come along, though he would be required to pay for his own ticket and keep well out of the way. The Palmerston was scheduled to break her journey in Sydney, spending 2 weeks loading and unloading cargo at Port Jackson before continuing on to Melbourne in the south. During these 2 weeks, Arsuk must keep to himself and not bother Carver, henceforth styled captain, in any way. When the Palmerston landed at Port Phillip, they would part as amicable strangers, owing nothing, expecting nothing. Thenceforth, they would never see each other again. Arsuk agreed. In a frenzy of sudden excitement, he relinquished his few possessions, changed his meagre savings into pounds, and purchased a standard ticket in the highest class of berth that Carver would permit him to occupy, third. He was, he soon discovered, the ship's only passenger. The journey to Sydney passed without incident. Looking back, Arsuk remembered it only as a static, nauseated haze, slowly brightening, like the onset of a migraine. As the craft made her long approach into the wide, low throat of the harbour, Arsuk, weak and malnourished after many weeks at sea, struggled from his berth at last and ventured topside. The quality of the light seemed very strange to him. He felt that in China the light was thinner, whiter, cleaner. The Australian light was very yellow, and there was a thickened quality to its brightness, as though the sun were always on the point of setting, even in the morning or at noon. Upon reaching the mooring at Darling Harbour, the ship's captain hardly paused to exchange his sea legs for a steadier gait. He walked down the Palmerston's gangway, along the quay, and into a dockside brothel without so much as a backward glance. His crew was fast upon his heels. In no time at all, therefore, Arsuk found himself alone. He left the ship, committing the location of its mooring to memory, and promptly set off inland, resolving, somewhat naively, to get a measure of the country in which he was to live. Arsuk's English was very poor, simply for the reason that he and Carver had always conducted their conversations in Cantonese, and he was not acquainted with any other English-speaking men. He looked for Chinese faces on the docks, in vain. Venturing further inland, he walked the streets for hours, looking for a painted sign, even a single character that he could understand. He found nothing.
Presently he ventured to the custom house, where he produced one of the banknotes that he had folded inside the band of his hat, and held it up. Perhaps the money could speak where he could not. The custom house official raised his eyebrows, but before he said a word, Ah Suk's hat was wrenched from his hand. He wheeled about and saw a boy, barefoot, running at speed away from him. Outraged, Ah Suk yelled and gave chase. But the boy was fast and knew the warren of the docks familiarly. Within minutes, he was gone. Ah Suk searched for the boy until well after nightfall. When finally he gave up and returned to the custom house, the customs officials only shook their heads and spread their hands. They pointed inland and spoke a volley of words. Ah Suk did not know what they were pointing at or what they were saying. He felt a sob rising in his throat. His hatband had contained all the money he owned, save for the single banknote that he'd been holding in his other hand. He was now all but destitute. Distraught, he removed his boot, placed this last banknote in the worn hollow beneath his heel, replaced his boot, and returned to the Palmerston. At least, he thought, there was one man in Sydney who could speak Cantonese. Ah Suk approached the brothel cautiously. From within he could hear the sound of a piano, the timbre unfamiliar to him. He felt that it had a squarish, comfortable sound. He was lingering on the threshold, wondering whether he should knock, when the door was wrenched open and a man appeared in the doorway. Ah Suk bowed. He attempted to explain, as courteously as he was able, that he wished to speak to a man named Carver, captain of the Palmerston. The man in the doorway responded with a string of unintelligible sounds. Ah Suk persisted, repeating Carver's name very slowly and carefully. He received the same response. Next, he tried to indicate with the flat of his hand that he wished to step around the man and venture inside so that he might speak to Carver himself. This was a mistake. The man grabbed Ah Suk's shirt collar with one enormous hand, picked him up, and threw him bodily into the street. Ah Suk fell painfully, jarring his wrist and his hip. The man pushed up his shirt sleeves and advanced down the stairs. He took one final drag of his cigar before throwing it, with a flick of his wrist, sideways into the quay. Then, grinning, he put up his fists. Ah Suk became very anxious. He put up his hands also to indicate that he did not wish to fight, and begged for mercy. The man called something over his shoulder, perhaps an instruction, and within moments a second man, his face much thinner, his nose more hooked, had appeared at the doorway of the brothel. This second man darted around behind Ah Suk, hauled him to his feet, and pinned his hands behind his back, a pose that left his face and torso undefended. The pair exchanged words. Ah Suk struggled, but he could not wrench his wrists free. The first man, raising his forearms in front of his face, shifted his weight lightly from foot to foot. He approached and then retreated several times, stepping very lightly, and then darted forward and began to batter Ah Suk's face and stomach with his fists. The man behind him crowed something. The first grunted in return and fell back, only to advance again in the same style and release a second flurry of blows. Soon the revelers inside the brothel were roused. They spilled into the street, bringing the noise of their party with them. Francis Carver appeared in the doorway of the brothel. He had removed his jacket. He was in ruffled shirt sleeves and a blue necktie, tied with a sloppy four-in-hand knot. He placed his hands loosely upon his hips and surveyed the fight with an irritated look. Ah Suk met his eyes.
"Ngoi Bongo!" he cried through a mouthful of blood. "Ngoi Bongo!"
Francis Carver seemed to look right through him. He made no sign that he could understand Ah Suk at all. One of the other revelers said something, and Carver responded in English, shifting his gaze away.
"Pang Yao! Oh, Pang Yao!"
But Carver did not look at him again. A copper-haired woman appeared next to him in the doorway, snaking beneath his arm. He caught her around the waist and pulled her body close to his own. He murmured something into her hair. She laughed, and they went back inside. Soon the second man could not support the dead weight of Ah Suk's body. He dropped him, complaining evidently of the blood that had spattered on his jacket and his cuffs. The first man began to kick Ah Suk where he lay, but evidently this was not as entertaining as his former sport, and soon the crowd lost interest and dispersed. The first man gave Ah Suk a final kick in the ribs with the toe of his boot, and then returned inside also. When he re-entered the brothel, there was a rising wave of laughter, and then the piano struck up a new tune. Using his elbows and his knees, Ah Suk dragged his broken body to the alley, out of sight. He lay in the shadow, feeling a sharp pain each time he drew a breath. He watched the masts of the ships move back and forth. The sun went down. After a time, he heard the lamplighter's tread upon the quay, and near him, the hiss and thump as the gas lamp was ignited. The darkness turned grey. He feared that all his ribs were broken. He could feel a sticky wetness like a sponge above his hairline. His left eye had closed. He did not know if he had strength enough to stand. Presently, the rear door of the brothel opened, spilling yellow light onto the stones. Quick steps padded into the alley. Ah Suk heard the clink of a tin bowl being set down upon the cobbles, and then felt a cool touch of a hand upon his brow. He opened his right eye. A young woman with a thinly pointed face and buck teeth was kneeling before him. Murmuring phrases he did not understand, she dipped a square of cloth in warm water and began to daub the blood from his face. He let her voice wash over him. She was wearing a starched apron in the manner of a barmaid. She must work inside, he thought. This guess was confirmed when, after a moment, there came a shouted summons from within, and, muttering, she put the cloth down and darted away. Several hours passed. The piano player ceased, and the noises from within began to dwindle. Ah Suk slept a while, and awoke to find that all was very quiet, and the barmaid had returned. This time she was carrying a caddy under one arm, several implements rolled in cloth, and a spirit lantern. She knelt beside him, placing the lantern carefully upon the cobbles, and twisting the dial so the globe flared white. Ah Suk turned his head as gently as he was able, and saw, with some surprise, that the caddy she was carrying bore his own family name, stamped in Chinese. He gave a start, which the woman interpreted strangely. She smiled and nodded, and placed her finger against her lips to signify a secret. She then opened the caddy, fished around amongst the tea leaves, and withdrew from the interior a small square package wrapped in paper. She smiled at him. Ah Suk was confused. He turned his head painfully to the right, so as to see the implements the woman had unrolled from her bundle, and saw a short, inelegant pipe laid out next to a needle, a knife, and a tin bowl. He turned back to her questioningly, but she was busy adjusting the wick of the lamp, assembling the pipe, and preparing the resin. When at last the opium was bubbling, and a tendril of white smoke escaped the thin aperture of the bowl, she pressed the mouthpiece of the pipe to Ah Suk's lips. He was too exhausted to decline. He took the vapor into his mouth and held it there. There came a dawn in his chest, a liquid light. A perfect calm flooded through his body. The pain in his head and chest drained out of him as simply and suddenly as water seeping through a piece of silk. Opium, he thought dully. Opium. It was extraordinary. The drug was extraordinary. It was a miracle, a cure. She passed him the pipe again, and he supped from its end greedily, like a beggar supping from a spoon. He did not remember passing out of consciousness, but when he next opened his eyes it was daylight and the barmaid was gone. He was lying propped between two slop crates at the back of the building, with a blanket spread over his body and another folded beneath his cheek. Someone, the barmaid perhaps, must have dragged him there. Or had he come here of his own accord? Ah Suk could not remember. He had a terrible headache, and the pain in his ribcage had returned. From within the building, he could hear splashing water and the sound of knives. Then he remembered the can of opium buried in the middle of the box of tea. Dent and Co. had been paying for their wares in opium, for Britain had no more silver and China had no need for gold. How could he have been so stupid? Francis Carver had been smuggling the drug into China using the Suk family warehouse as a liaison point. Francis Carver had betrayed his father. Francis Carver had turned away from him and pretended not to understand his cry. Ah Suk lay on his side in the alley without moving. A deadly conviction was swelling in his chest. Over the course of the next week, the buck-toothed woman kept him fed, watered, and sedated. She checked upon him several times daily, always under the pretense of feeding the pig, emptying the dishwater, or taking the laundry to the buckled line. After nightfall, she came with the pipe and fed him smoke until the pain lessened and he fell asleep. She conducted these ministrations in silence, and Ah Suk, as he watched her, was quiet too. He wondered about her. One night she came out with her own eye blackened. He raised his hand to touch it, but she frowned and turned away. Within a few days, Ah Suk could stand, though it was painful to do so, and within the week he could walk slowly around the yard. He knew that the Palmerston had only scheduled a fortnight stopover in Sydney. Soon it would be departing for the Victorian goldfields in the south. Ah Suk no longer cared whether he continued on to Melbourne. He wanted only to confront Carver before the clipper sailed. Since the Palmerston had reached her mooring, Carver had not spent a single night aboard. He spent his nights at the dockside brothel in the company of the woman with copper-coloured hair. Ah Suk saw him approaching every evening, striding along the quay with his arms swinging and his coat-tails flared. He did not leave the brothel until the early hours of the afternoon, and very often the copper-haired woman accompanied him to the alley doorway to bid him a private goodbye. Ah Suk had twice glimpsed the pair walking along the docks together, well after sundown. They spoke as intimates. Each leant in close to listen when the other spoke, and the woman's hand was always in the crook of Carver's elbow, pressing close. The eighth night after Ah Suk's assault was a Sunday, and the carousing at the brothel quit well before midnight in accordance with curfew. Ah Suk crept around to the front of the place and saw Carver silhouetted in the central window of the upper floor, leaning his forearm against the lintel and looking down into the dark. As Ah Suk watched, the red-haired woman came up behind him, caught his sleeve in her hand, and pulled him back out of sight into the depths of the room. Keeping to the shadows, Ah Suk crept back to the sash window above the kitchen cutting board and slid it open. He climbed inside. The room was deserted. He looked around for a weapon, selecting finally a bone-handled cleaver from the rack above the board. He had never wielded a weapon of any kind against another man, but it gave him confidence to feel the thing heavy in his hand. He moved to find the staircase in the gloom. There were three doors at the top of the staircase, all of them closed. He listened at the first, only silence, and then the second, muted scuffling, and then the third, behind which he could hear the rumble of a man's voice, the creak of a chair, and then a woman's low reply. Ah Suk tried to estimate the distance from the edge of the house to the upper window at which he had seen Carver standing moments before. Could this third door lead to that central room? Did it square? Yes, for he was 10 feet from the edge of the landing, and if he imagined the brothel's frontage in his mind, the window was easily 12 feet from the building's edge. Unless the second door led to a larger room, of course, and this third door led to a small one. Ah Suk put his ear to the door. He heard the man raise his voice and speak several words in English, sharply and with a terse accent, as though he were very displeased. It must be Carver, Ah Suk thought. It could only be Carver. Full of sudden fury, he wrenched the door open. But it was not Carver. It was the man who had beaten him little more than a week earlier. He had the buck-toothed woman on his lap, one hand encircling her throat, the other spread flat across her breast.
Ah Suk stepped back in surprise, and the man, roaring his displeasure, threw the woman from his lap and leapt to his feet. He uttered a string of syllables that Ah Suk did not understand, and reached for his revolver, which was lying on a nightstand next to the bed. In the same instant, the buck-toothed woman reached into her bosom and withdrew a muff pistol. The man levelled his gun and pulled the hammer. Ah Suk flinched, but the mechanism jammed. There was a spent casing in the breech. By the time the man had tipped his revolver up to release the spent casing, the woman had rushed upon him and shoved the muzzle of her pistol into his temple. Distracted, he tried to push her away, and there was a clap, and the man crumpled. His revolver fell from his hand and thudded upon the floor. Ah Suk had not moved. The buck-toothed woman darted forward, removed the revolver from the dead man's hand, and fitted her own muff pistol in place of it. She then thrust the heavy revolver upon Ah Suk, closed his fingers over the barrel, and motioned for him to leave, and leave quickly. Bewildered, he turned on his heel, revolver in one hand, cleaver in the other. She grabbed his shoulders, yanked him back, and directed him instead to the servant's stairwell on the other side of the hall, down which he vanished, hearing footsteps and clamour on the main stair. Outside, Ah Suk tossed both weapons into the water and watched them sink rapidly out of view. There came screaming from inside and muffled shouts. He turned and began to run. Before he reached the end of the quay, he heard footsteps behind him. Then something struck him on the back, and he fell face first upon the ground. He gave a grunt of pain, his ribs were still very tender, and felt his hands being cuffed roughly behind him. He did not protest as he was hoisted to his feet, marched to the horse post, and shoved against it. His captor then cuffed him with a second pair of handcuffs to the iron ring, where he remained until the policeman's wagon arrived to take him to jail. Ah Suk could not make head or tail of the questions that were put to him in English, and at length his interrogators despaired of him. He was not afforded the courtesy of a translator, and when he said the name Carver, the policemen only shook their heads. He was placed in cramped custody with five other men. In due course, the case was heard and judged to warrant a trial, which was scheduled to take place some 6 weeks later. By this time, the Palmerston must have long since departed. Carver, in all likelihood, was gone for good. Ah Suk passed the next 6 weeks in a state of great anxiety and dejection, and awoke on the morning of his trial as if upon the day of his very execution. How could he hope to defend himself? He would be convicted and hanged before the month was out. The case was heard in English, and Ah Suk from the dock understood virtually none of it. He was surprised when, after several hours of speeches and swearings in, Francis Carver was brought to the stand in handcuffs. Ah Suk wondered why this witness was the only one to have been restrained. He stood up as Carver approached the stand and called out to him in Cantonese. Their gaze met, and in the sudden stillness, Ah Suk, speaking calmly and distinctly, promised to avenge his father's death. Carver, to his dishonour, was the first to look away. It was only much later that Ah Suk learnt the nature of what transpired during the trial. The name of the man he was accused of having murdered, as he later discovered, was Jeremy Shepherd, and the buck-toothed woman who had nursed Ah Suk back to health was his wife, Margaret. The copper-haired woman was Lydia Greenway. She was the proprietrix of the Darling Harbour brothel, which was known as the White Horse Saloon. At the time of his trial, Ah Suk knew no names at all. It was not until the morning after his acquittal that he found a copy of the Sydney Herald and was able to pay a Cantonese trader to translate the account given in the courthouse pages, which, owing to its sensational nature, ran over three columns, nearly filling an entire page. The case of the prosecutor, according to the Sydney Herald, rested upon 3 points. Firstly, that Ah Suk had a very good reason to bear a grudge against Jeremy Shepherd, given that the latter had beaten him senseless the week before. Secondly, that Ah Suk had been apprehended fleeing the White Horse Saloon in the moments after the shot was fired, which naturally made him the most likely suspect.
and thirdly, that Chinese men in general could not be trusted, and indeed bore an inherent malice against all white men. The defence, in the face of these charges, was lackadaisical. The lawyer reasoned that it was unlikely that Ah Suk, being but a fraction of Shepherd's height and weight, could have got close enough to place the muzzle of the pistol against the other man's temple. For this reason, the possibility of suicide ought not to be ruled out. When the prosecutor interjected to assert that the act of suicide was, by the testimony of his friends, vehemently against Jeremy Shepherd's nature, the defence ventured the opinion that no man on earth was wholly incapable of suicide, a surmise that received a sharp reprimand from the judge. Begging the judge's pardon, the lawyer concluded his argument by suggesting, as a kind of general summation, that perhaps Suk Yong Sheng had only fled the White Horse in alarm. A shot had just been fired, after all. When he sat down, the prosecutor made no effort to hide his smirk, and the judge sighed very audibly. At last, the prosecutor called for the testimony of Margaret Shepherd, Jeremy Shepherd's widow, and it was here that the trial took a startling turn. Upon the stand, Margaret Shepherd flatly refused to corroborate with the prosecutor's line of questioning. She insisted that Suk Yong Sheng had not murdered her husband. She knew this to be true for a very simple reason. She had witnessed his suicide herself. This startling confession gave rise to such an uproar in the court that the judge was obliged to call for order. Ah Suk, to whom these events would only be translated long after the fact, never dreamt that the woman was risking her own safety in order to save his life. When Margaret Shepherd's questioning was allowed to continue, the prosecutor inquired as to why she had hitherto concealed this very vital information, to which Margaret Shepherd replied that she had lived in great fear of her husband, for he abused her daily, as more than one witness could attest. Her spirit was all but broken. She had only just mustered the courage to speak of the incident aloud. After this poignant testimony, the trial dissolved. The judge had no choice but to acquit Ah Suk of the crime of murder and to release him. Jeremy Shepherd, it was decreed, had committed suicide, may God rest his soul, though that prospect was, theologically speaking, very unlikely. Ah Suk's first action upon his release from jail was to seek news of Francis Carver. He learned to his surprise that in fact the Palmerston had been apprehended in the Sydney harbour some weeks ago, following a routine search. Francis Carver had been found in breach of the law on charges of smuggling, breach of customs, and evasion of duty. According to the report given to the Maritime Police, there were 16 young women from Guangzhou in the ship's hold, all of them severely malnourished and frightened in the extreme. The Palmerston had been seized, the women had been sent back to China, Carver had been remanded in jail, and Carver's relationship with Dent & Co. had been formally dissolved. He had been sentenced to 10 years of penal servitude at the penitentiary upon Cockatoo Island, effective instant. There was nothing to do but wait for Carver's sentence to elapse. Ah Suk sailed to Victoria and began to dig the ground. He acquired some facility in English, apprenticed himself to various trades, and dreamed with increasing lucidity of avenging his father's murder by taking Carver's life. In July 1864, he sent a written inquiry to Cockatoo Island, requesting to know where Carver had gone upon his liberation. He received an answer 3 months later, informing him that Carver had sailed to Dunedin, New Zealand, upon the steamer Sparta. Ah Suk bought a ticket there also, and in Dunedin the trail suddenly went cold. He searched and searched, and found nothing. At last, defeated, Ah Suk gave up the case as lost. He bought a miner's right and a one-way ticket to the West Coast, where, 8 months later, he chanced upon him. Standing in the street, his face newly scarred, his chest newly thickened, counting coins into Te Rau Taufare's hand. Ah Suk found Ah Kui sitting cross-legged on a shelf of gravel some few feet from the boundary peg that marked the Aurora's southeast corner. The goldsmith held a prospector's dish in both hands, and he was shaking the dish rhythmically, flicking out his wrists in the confident motion of a man long practiced in a single skill. There was a lit cigarette in the corner of his mouth, but he did not appear to be smoking it. The ash shredded finely down his tunic as he moved. Before him was a wooden trough of water, and beside him an iron crucible with a flattened spout. His rhythm followed a circular pattern. First he shook the largest stones and clods out of his dish, keeping to a persistent tempo so that the finest sands tumbled by degrees to the bottom of the pan. Then he leant forward, dipped the far edge of the pan into the clouded water, and with a sharp movement tilted the pan back towards his body, swirling the liquid carefully clockwise to create a vortex in the dish. Gold was heavier than stone and sank to the bottom. Once he skimmed the wet gravel from the surface, the pure metal would be left behind, shining wetly, tiny points of light against the dark. Arqui plucked out these glistering flakes with his fingers and transferred them carefully to his crucible. He then refilled his dish with earth and stones and repeated the procedure with no variation whatsoever until the sun sank below the treetops to the west. The aurora was a good distance from both the river and the sea, an inconvenience that accounted in part for its undesirability as a gold mine. It was necessary for Arqui to transport his own river water to the claim every morning, for without water his task was all but impossible. Once the water was clouded with dirt and silt, however, it was very hard to see the gold, and he was obliged to tramp back to the river in order to fill his buckets again. A tail race might have been constructed from the Hokitika River, or a shaft might have been dropped for a well, but the gold mine's owner had made it clear from the outset that he would spare the Aurora no resources at all. There was no point. The 2 acres that comprised the Aurora was only barely payable ground. It was only a dull patch of stones, treeless. The tailing pile at Arqui's back, testament to long hours of solitary industry, was long and low, a burial mound under which no body had been interred. Arqui looked up as Arsuk approached.
Niho! Niho! Niho!
The two men regarded each other with neither hostility nor kindness, but the gaze they shared was long. After a moment, Arqui plucked the last of the cigarette from his mouth and flicked it away over the stones.
"The yield is small today," he said in Cantonese.
1,000 sympathies," replied Arsuk, speaking in his native language also.
"The yield is small every day.
You deserve better."
"Do I?"
said Arqui, who was in an irritable temper.
"Yes," said Arsuk. "Diligence deserves to be rewarded."
"In what proportion? And in what currency? These are empty words."
Arsuk placed the palms of his hands together.
"I come bearing good news."
"Good news and flattery,"
Arqui observed. The hatter took no notice of this correction.
"Emery Staines has returned," he said.
Arqui stiffened.
"Oh," he said, "you have seen him?"
"Not yet," said Arsuk. "I am told that he will be in Hokitika tonight, at a hotel upon Revel Street, where a celebration has been planned to welcome his return. I have been invited, and as a gesture of my good faith, I extend my invitation to you."
"Who is your host?"
"Anna Wetherill, and the widow of the dead man Crosby Wells."
"Two women,"
said Arqui skeptically.
"Yes," said Arsuk.
He hesitated, and then admitted what he had discovered that morning, that in fact, Crosby's widow was the very same woman who had operated the White Horse Saloon in Darling Harbour, who had testified against Arsuk at his own trial, and who had once been the lover of his enemy Francis Carver. Formerly Lydia Greenway, her name was now Lydia Wells. Arqui took a moment to digest this information.
"This is a trap," he said at last.
"No," said Arsuk. "I came here of my own accord, not under instruction."
"This is a trap to capture you," said Arqui. "I am sure of it. Why else would your presence be so specifically requested at the celebration tonight? You have no connection to Mr. Staines. What purpose can you serve in a party to welcome his return?"
"I am to play a part in a stage drama. I am to sit on a cushion and pretend to be a statue."
This sounded foolish even to Ah-Suk. He rushed on.
It is a kind of theatre. I shall be paid a fee for my participation.
You shall be paid?
Yes, as a performer.
Ah-Kui studied him.
What if the woman Greenway is still in league with Francis Carver? They were lovers once. Perhaps she has already sent word to him that you will be present at the party tonight.
Carver is at sea.
Even so, she will notify him as soon as she can.
When that happens, I will be ready.
How will you be ready?
I will be ready,
Ah-Suk said stubbornly.
It does not matter yet. Carver is at sea.
The woman's allegiance is with him, and you have sworn to avenge yourself upon him, as she must remember. She cannot wish you well.
I will be on my guard.
Ah-Kui sighed. He stood, brushing himself down, and then he paused, inhaling sharply through his nose. He advanced several steps upon Ah-Suk and gripped his shoulders in both hands.
You reek with it, he said. You are reeling on your feet, Suk Yongcheng. I can smell the stink of it from 20 paces.
Ah-Suk had indeed detoured past his den at Canyeri to smoke his late afternoon pipe, of which the effects were very plainly visible. But he did not like to be chastised. He wrestled himself from Ah-Kui's grasp, saying sourly,
I have a weakness! A weakness!
Ah-Kui cried. He spat into the dirt.
It is not weakness. It is hypocrisy. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Do not speak to me as to a child.
A man addicted is a childish man.
Then I am a childish man, said Ah-Suk. It is not of consequence to you.
It is of great consequence to me if I am to accompany you tonight.
I have no need of your protection.
If that is what you believe, you are deluded, said Ah-Kui.
Deluded and a hypocrite,
said Ah-Suk, feigning astonishment.
Two insults when I have been nothing but courteous to you.
You deserve to be insulted, said Ah-Kui. You indulge the very drug that killed your father, and you have the audacity to style yourself his defender. You insist he was betrayed, and yet you betray him every time you light your lamp.
Francis Carver killed my father, said Ah-Suk, stepping back.
Opium killed your father, said Ah-Kui. Look at yourself.
For Ah-Suk had stumbled against a root and partly fallen.
You are a fine avenger, Suk Yongcheng, one who cannot even stand on his own two feet.
Furious, Ah-Suk put a hand out to steady himself, hauled himself upright, and rounded on Ah-Kui, his pupils dark and soft.
You know my history, he said. I was first given the drug as a medicine. I did not take it of my own accord. I cannot help its power over me. You had ample time to shake your addiction, said Ah-Kui. You were imprisoned for weeks before your trial, were you not?
That interval was not sufficient to rid me of the craving.
The craving, said Ah-Kui, full of contempt. What a pathetic word that is. No wonder it has no place in the history you recounted to me. No wonder you prefer such grand words as honor and duty and betrayal and revenge.
My history,
your history as you tell it, dwells far longer on your own injustices than on the shame that was brought upon your family. Tell me, Suk Yongcheng, are you avenging yourself upon the man who killed your father, or the man who refused to come to your aid outside the White Horse Saloon?
Ah-Suk was shocked.
You doubt my motives, he said.
Your motives are not your own, said Ah-Kui. They cannot be your own. Look at yourself. You can hardly stand.
There was a silence between them. From the adjacent valley there came a muffled crack of gunshot, and then a distant cry. Finally, Ah-Suk nodded.
Goodbye, he said. Why do you farewell me?
You have made your opinions clear, said Ah-Suk. You disapprove of me. You are disgusted by me. I will go to the widow's celebration tonight regardless.
Though Ah-Kui's temper was quick to flare,
He could not bear to be made the villain in any dispute. He shook his head, breathing hard through his nose, and said,
I will come with you. I want very much to speak to Mr. Staines.
I know, said Ah Suk. I came here on good faith, Kui Long.
When Ah Kui spoke again, his voice was quiet.
A man knows his own heart. I was wrong to doubt your motivation.
Ah Suk closed his eyes briefly.
By the time we reach Hokitika, he said, opening them again, I will be sober.
Ah Kui nodded.
You will need to be, he said.
Cardinal Earth, in which Walter Moody makes a startling discovery. Several confusions are put to rest, and a symmetry presents itself. Walter Moody, upon taking his leave of Gascoigne, had returned at once to the Crown Hotel, to which place his trunk had been delivered. He wrenched the door open, crossed the foyer at a pace, and took the stairs to the upper landing, two by two. When he reached the door at the top of the stairs, he fumbled with his key in the keyhole and cursed aloud. He was suddenly absurdly impatient to lay eyes upon his possessions, feeling that his reunion with the treasured items of his former life would somehow repair a connection that, since the wreck of the Godspeed, had seemed very unreal. Of late, Moody's thoughts had been drifting with increasing frequency back to his reunion with his father in Dunedin. He found that he regretted the haste with which he had quitted the unhappy scene. It was true that his father had betrayed him. It was true that his brother had betrayed him. But even so, he might have been forgiving. He might have stayed on and heard Frederick's part in the story. He had not seen his brother while in Dunedin, for he had fled the scene of reunion with his father before Frederick could be summoned, and so he did not know whether Frederick was well or married or happy. He did not know what Frederick had made of Otago, and whether he meant to live out his days in New Zealand. He did not know whether his father and brother had dug the ground as a party, or whether they had gone mates with other men, or whether they had prospected alone. Whenever Moody dwelt upon these uncertainties, he felt sad. He ought to have sought an audience with his brother. But would Frederick have desired such a thing? Even that, Moody did not know. Since arriving in Hokitika, he had thrice sat down to write to him, but after penning the salutation and the date, sat motionless. At last, the key turned in the lock. Moody shoved open the door, strode into the room, and stopped. There was indeed a trunk in the middle of the room, but it was a trunk he had never seen before. His own trunk was painted red and was rectangular in its dimensions. This one was black, with iron straps, and a long square hasp through which a horizontal bar had been thrust to keep it closed. Its lid was domed and slatted like a barrel that had been laid upon its side. There were several baggage labels plastered to the half-barrel of the lid, one marked Southampton, one marked Littleton, and the standard, not wanted on voyage. Moody could tell at once that the trunk's owner had always travelled first class. Instead of ringing the bell to inform the maid of the mistake, Moody closed the door behind him, locked it, and moved forward to kneel before the unfamiliar chest. He unfastened the hasp, and heaved open the lid, and saw, pasted to the underside, a square of paper that read, Property of Mr. Alistair Lauderback, Provincial Councilman MP. Moody exhaled and sat back on his heels. Now this was a misunderstanding. So Lauderback's trunk had been aboard Godspeed, as Balfour had suspected. The shipping crate must indeed have been wrongly taken from the Hokitika quay. Moody's trunk, like Lauderback's, was not engraved with the name of its owner, and bore no particular marks of identification save for on the interior, where his name and address had been stamped into a square of leather and sewn into the lining of the lid. Presumably the two trunks had been switched. Moody's trunk had been delivered to Lauderback's rooms at the Palace Hotel and Lauderback's to the Crown. Moody thought for a moment. Lauderback was not currently in Hokitika. According to the West Coast Times, he was campaigning in the north and was not due to return until tomorrow afternoon. Suddenly decisive, Moody shucked off his jacket, leant forward on his knees, and began to go through Lauderback's belongings. Walter Moody did not chastise himself for intrusions upon other people's privacy, and nor did he see any reason to confess them. His mind was of a most phlegmatic sort, cool in its private applications, quick and excessively rational. He possessed a fault common to those of high intelligence, however, which was that he tended to regard the gift of his intellect as a license of a kind, by whose rarefied authority he was protected in all circumstances from ever behaving ill. He considered his moral obligations to be of an altogether different class than those of lesser men, and so rarely felt shame or compunction, except in very general terms. He went through Lord Aback's chest swiftly and methodically, handling each item and then replacing it exactly as he found it. The trunk contained largely items of stationery, letter sets, seals, ledgers, books of law, and all the necessities that might furnish the desk of a Member of Parliament. Lord Aback's clothing and personal effects had presumably been packed elsewhere, for the only item of clothing in this cedar chest was a woolen scarf, which had been wrapped around a rather ugly brass paperweight in the shape of a pig. The trunk carried with it the smell of the sea, a briny odour less salty than sour. But its contents were hardly even damp. Mercifully for Lord Aback, the trunk must have been spared a full immersion. At the bottom of the trunk was a leather briefcase. Moody opened it and withdrew a sheaf of papers, all of them contracts, receipts, and bills of sale. After several minutes' searching, he found the deed for the sale of the bark Godspeed, and pulled that document free of the others, handling it carefully so that the legal seal did not crumble or pull away. The contract had been signed, as Lord Aback had attested to Balfour 3 weeks ago, by a Mr. Francis Wells. The date of the sale also corroborated with the politician's story. The ship had changed ownership in May of 1865, 9 months prior to the present day. Moody bent closer to look at the purchaser's signature. Francis Wells had signed his false name expansively. The inscriber had made a huge looping flourish on the left-hand side of the capital F, so large that it might have been a letter of its own. Moody squinted at it sideways. Why, he thought, in fact, that flourish might have easily been a C cursively joined to the next letter. He peered closer. There was even a dot of ink between the C and the F, a dot that one might have taken for a spatter if one glanced at the paper carelessly, which seemed to suggest that Carver had signed the name deliberately ambiguously so that it might read either Francis Wells merely or C. Francis Wells. The penmanship was rather shaky, as often happens when one writes very slowly, wishing to ensure a particular effect. Moody was frowning. In June of the previous year, Francis Carver had been in possession of Crosby Wells' birth certificate, a document that proved, as Benjamin Lerventhal had attested, that Crosby Wells' middle name was Francis. Why, Moody thought, it was plain enough. Francis Carver had stolen Crosby Wells' birth certificate with the intention of posing as the other man. The ambiguities of this bill of sale must surely be deliberate. If Carver were brought to court on the charge of false impersonation, he could deny that he had ever signed it. Was the shared name Francis merely a happy coincidence, or could Wells' birth certificate have been falsified after the fact? A middle name would be very easy to add to any document, Moody thought, and one could easily use a lighter shade of ink or fade the word somehow to mask the fact of the later addition. But why should Carver have wanted to falsify his own identity, most especially upon a bill of sale? How could it have been to his advantage to use another man's name? Moody reviewed what he knew about the matter. Francis Carver had used Crosby Wells' identity when speaking to Benjamin Lerventhal in the office of the West Coast Times in June, but he had not used Crosby Wells' identity when confronting Alistair Lord Aback the month before. To Lord Aback, he had called himself Francis Wells, and then he had signed his name with deliberate ambiguity. Bearing in mind Lord Aback's mysterious belief that Crosby Wells and Carver had been brothers, Moody could only assume that Carver had posed as Crosby Wells' brother in his dealings with Lord Aback. As to why he might have done such a thing, however, Moody had no idea. He scrutinized the bill of sale for a long moment committing its particulars to memory, and then returned it to the briefcase, slotted the briefcase back into the trunk, and continued with his methodical investigation. At length he was satisfied that the trunk contained no more clues that were of use to him, and in a gesture that was partly idle, ran his fingers around the edge of the lid. All of a sudden he gave a murmur of surprise. A slim package, squarish in shape, had been slipped beneath the calico lining so that it lay concealed between the cedar and the cloth. He bent closer, and his fingers found a neat slit in the fabric, roughly the size of the span of his hand, and delicately hemmed so that it would not fray. The calico lining was stamped with a tartan pattern, and the slit in the cloth was cleverly disguised against the vertical stripes of the tartan, which ran flush with the edge of the trunk. Moody wormed his fingers into the cavity and withdrew the squarish object that his fingers had located. It was a wad of letters tied with string. There were around 15 letters in total, each addressed to Lauderback in a plain and unsophisticated hand. Moody took a moment to memorize the look of the knot and the length of the strings of the bow. He then untied the ends, tossed the string to one side, and smoothed the folded letters over his knee. He could see from their postmarks that they were arranged in reverse chronological order, with the most recent letter first. He shuffled to the back of the pile, selected the very first letter that Lauderback had received, and began to read it. In the next moment, his heart jumped into his throat.
Dunedin, March 1852. Sir, you are my brother, though you do not know me. Your father sired a bastard, I am that bastard. I was raised Crosby Wells, taking the surname of my parish priest, not knowing my father, but knowing myself a whoreson. I passed my childhood in the Newington Hall House, the Jewel. I have lived a modest life, such as I am able, as a man of little means. I have not suffered. However, I desired always to see my father, just to know his shape and voice. Finally, these prayers were answered with a letter from the man himself. He had always known of me, he wrote. He expected he would soon be gone and confessed he would not identify me in his will for fear of tarnishing his name, but he enclosed me £20 and blessings. He did not sign his name, but I made inquiries about the servant who had brought the note and tracked his carriage, though it was a rented one, to Glen House, your father's.